Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:35 on the afternoon of Monday, March 28th, 2011. We have a quorum to conduct business here. Senator Paskin is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator French. And there are two matters to come before the committee today, SB 98, dealing with biometric information, and SB 15, dealing with an aggravator for those who serve alcohol to young individuals. In conjunction with a sex assault case. Let's turn first to Senate Bill 98. We have a blank CS before us, /D. There should be a motion to accept that.
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilikowski has moved that we adopt a /D. I'll object for the purposes of discussion and turn now to Senator Wilikowski for an explanation of what the bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to call up my staff member, Michael Caulfield.
Mr. Caulfield, welcome.
Thank you.
Back to the committee.
Yes.
Tell us what /D does.
Okay, so because we've had some substantial rewrites to the document, I think I'll just run through it section by section quickly.
Sure.
So
if you can just point out, well, when you get to places that differ from the original bill, just point those out.
Okay. Okay. I mean, it's substantially written differently. It does a lot of the same things. So
fair enough. And just walk us through the bill, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. So So now section 1814.010, which is, it now is more strict guidelines on exactly how the collecting agency of the biometric information has to notify exactly what is being collected, how long it will be kept for, and the exact purpose of the use. And then it also details that there must be a written or other documented form of consent from the person whose biometric information is being collected. And it says, unless the individual's biometric information was needed for a specific authorized law enforcement, security, or fraud prevention purpose, the individual will be able to revoke that consent at any time. The second section now is completely different from the previous second section, 020 of the
previous. When you say second section, what you mean, I think, is just as we go through the bill,
020
statute. Okay, yeah. Section 1814.020. Very good.
And now that pertains to the disclosure of biometric information. It instructs that a collector of the information will not disclose, distribute, or transfer the data to anyone else, except for organizations that are specifically in service to hold biometric information.
And I'm looking on line 5. It says, except to a contractor or to a person to authenticate the identity of the individual providing the biometric information. I understand the second part, but I take it the contractor is the entity you were just describing?
Yes, yes, the contractor that will be able to authenticate who the person is and make sure that, you know, it's the person that whose information that they're acquiring.
Okay.
And then 030 is the sale of biometric information. It's pretty clear. It just says that a person will not sell information. The only exception is for if a contractor is bought out by another company. For instance, the company we heard about last time, ChoicePoint, was bought out by LexisNexis at one point. So we want to be able to, you know, if there's a business transaction like that, the business will be able to be, you know, transferred in a legal way.
So no one's going to sell my data, but if my data is collected with 50,000 other people's data, that collective agency can be bought and sold, as is common in the business world?
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Or 040 is on the disposal of data. We have a statute in here that says that if an individual requests their data be removed from the database that it's being stored in, it can be removed. We have 120 days that that the company has to remove that data. We also have it in here that if the reason for the data, if the reason for the data was collected is not needed anymore. So if the data was collected for a specific reason, and that reason is not needed anymore, it will be deleted after 120 days. Section 050, starting on line 25, is the use. It says that the biometric information will not be used for marketing purposes or for general surveillance purposes, but a collector may use the biometric information for a specific authorized security or fraud prevention purpose in addition to the specific purpose for which the biometric information was collected. The storage of biometric information just instructs on, which is 060, it instructs that the company or organization that's storing the data will do it in a safe, encrypted way to make sure that it cannot be stolen or lost in any way. And then 070 is a private right of action, which is almost identical to what we had last time, except it includes the word knowingly, because we want to make sure that, say, if a company has been instructed to tell the storage company to remove the biometric information, we want to make sure that the company that that forgot to tell or did not tell the company to delete the information is the one that is held responsible. The exemptions in 080 are the same as in the last bill, and then the definitions are the same as well.
Thank you. Good overview. Senator Wilikowski.
If I could just make a general statement, Mr. Chair. We had a number of concerns that were raised to us, and I think the biggest concern was raised just regarding security issues. People, for instance, hospitals had contacted us and said they have data collection areas where they require people to use a thumbprint to get in. We had security people contact us about similar types of circumstances. So we just felt that there was no way we could go forward on the bill unless we took out the alternate identification section, which I know is going to cause a lot of consternation to some people, but we just didn't feel we just couldn't come up with some alternative language to get around that. And so I think this, what we did was we tightened up some of the other provisions of the bill, the security provisions, so that when people get that, we think the new provisions are require a little bit more security of that information. And I think it's a little bit more, it's a bill that hopefully will gain a little bit broader support at this point, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Other comments? We do have several people signed up to testify. Why don't we go ahead and turn to them, get their perspectives before we do much more work on the bill. And we'll start with Chris Oswald. If you can hear my voice, go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and go ahead and give us your testimony. Chris Oswald.
Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Christopher Oswald, and I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for Reed Elsevier LexisNexis. I handle the Western region, and I believe that my colleague, Teresa Jennings, who's the Managing Director for State Government Affairs, is also on the line. I don't know if she's muted or not, but I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for agreeing to hear hear our testimony today. We certainly appreciate your affording us this opportunity. We also wanted to thank Senator Wilikowski and his staffers, Michael and Michelle, for working with us to produce the changes to the bill that we think greatly improve it, striking that balance by finding workable solutions for commercial purposes and still securing privacy and security. Wanted to simply start by saying that biometrics is an emerging technology, and like any other emerging technologies, there are a lot of questions surrounding its use and application. So again, we appreciate the opportunity to set the record straight on LexisNexis and our applications using biometrics. By way of introduction, LexisNexis Risk Solutions is a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. We're the leader in providing essential information that helps advance industry and society, and our cutting-edge technologies and our unique data analytics provide solutions that address evolving client needs and our customers in the risk sector while still upholding high standards of security and privacy. Specifically, our LexisNexis True ID product is an identity verification and biometric authentication solution that works to verify identities in face-to-face transactions, and it helps our customers fight fraudulent enrollment and fraudulent access to controlled systems. So just as Senator Wilikowski mentioned, these applications can be used in hospitals, I believe an example you've heard of is for professional licensing exams, ensuring that the person that is authorized to take the test is that person, verifying that identity and verifying that person when they go to take breaks in the middle of the test, things like that. So it's important to note, I think, Mr. Chairman, for the committee, to note that LexisNexis is merely the repository of this biometric data. We don't own the data, so we do not sell it, nor do we transfer the data beyond the original, and we don't use it for beyond the original purpose for which it was given to us originally. The information that we hold, the biometric information that we hold, is held in our secure database in Alpharetta, Georgia, and we have another secure backup system within the United States. So the biometric data that we hold for domestic customers is never transferred outside of the United States. We believe, I'll keep our testimony brief here, but we believe that the revised version of Senate Bill 98, again, makes the sensible changes that are needed to strike the balance between allowing legitimate commercial use of biometric technology while still protecting the privacy interests of the individual. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we thank you again for your indulgence in hearing our testimony, and we'll stand by to take any questions from you or the committee.
Mr. Oswald, thank you. I have a question from Senator Pascvan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicate that the Risk Solutions Division of LexisNexis keeps biometric data. Specifically, what is it that you keep in that area of biometric data?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I can't hear the question.
Sure.
We'll try it again.
Thank you. You indicated that the Risk Solutions Division of LexisNexis keeps biometric data. What types of biometric data do you collect?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we collect the information that is given to us by our customers. Generally, this is, in large part, I believe, fingerprint scans and crunching the biometric data from that. It could be other solutions in the future. It could be voice print or other biometric solutions that may come up as emerging technology. But generally now, my understanding is it's just fingerprints.
So simply fingerprints. And then how often does the Risk Solution Division of LexisNexis use fingerprints, for example, to confirm that someone was, for example, the taker of a test?
Well, that Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's exactly what we do. What we do is we initially collect the information given to us by the entity looking for this solution. So, again, it would be an initial fingerprint scan that we then hold in reserve, and then we verify that identity. Verify the print versus the template that's given to us, and we can do that in real time as often as is needed by the entity seeking the solution. So we can do it, again, in real time to verify that, yes, the fingerprint that is sent to us electronically matches one that we have on file, or we can do that in a batch situation towards the end of the day or at the end of the week.
When you say you compare it against something, so if someone comes in to take a test and they give a fingerprint, what do you compare that biometric data against? And how did you get that in the first place?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator, that is what happens, you know, initially when the customer comes to us and says, you know, we would like to engage in your solution. We have to take an initial scan of that fingerprint to have on file. And so that is where the notice comes in to the individual. They can choose to abide by it or not. But that serves as the template for which we bounce our solution off of. So there is that initial template that we gain with the consent of the individual and knowledge of the individual that then we hold, and then we are simply the matching service that when that person again puts their fingerprint down, we verify that against what we have on file to give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down to authenticate their identity.
Mr. Chairman, this is Teresa Jennings, and I'd like to see if I can add a little bit to the answer to that question, if I may.
We'd be happy to have you do so. Ms. Jennings, just go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and then go ahead.
Thank you, sir. My name is Teresa Jennings. As my colleague mentioned, I'm the Managing Director of State Government Affairs for Reed Elsevier. And I think, Senator, who asked the question, it might be helpful to think of the biometrics information as the difference between a bank vault versus a security deposit box. So when you think of what goes into a bank, and that's what most people think of when they're thinking of LexisNexis, they think it's a great deal of information, just like there's a great deal of money in a bank vault. But what goes into a security, a safe deposit box is secure and is only accessed by the person who puts that information into the box. So to answer your question about what we need in order to verify the individual who put the fingerprint scan in the hands of our client, we would need the finger. And sometimes that's all that is given to us to be put in essentially that safe deposit box. Sometimes if it's, let's say, airline security, they might put a little bit more information into that safe deposit box. But ultimately, how that is verified is only based on what the client gives us to hold with that information. It does not get commingled with the rest of the information that LexisNexis holds. Does that help you, sir?
Actually, I'm still fuzzy. I don't know if Senator Pascan is, but let's just use a bar examination. We've got three attorneys on this panel. We've all taken it. Take a bar examination as an example. I want to sign up and take the bar exam. I take it your customer in this instance would not be me, the individual, but really a company administering the test. Just walk me through how I, as a person taking the test, get identified through my fingerprint.
Each time you walk in and out of the room, when you sign up for the day, you take a scan of that fingerprint. The circumstance that we are concerned about was an instance where the entity establishing the exam, and for the multi-state exam, for example, they might go through a number of questions. It takes a great deal of time and effort and money to set these questions. So there can be multiple millions of dollars worth of questions for a multi-state bar exam or for some other licensing type of exam. Professional test takers have indeed in the past taken the place of people who have signed in for these exams, and they either finish taking the exams for them or they steal the test questions. And that's been a real problem for these entities that are our clients. So imagine if I'm sitting for the bar exam, it might be a day-long exam. It might be actually multiple days, which it was when I took the bar exam in the Maryland area. Every time I go in and out of that room, my fingerprint would again be scanned to make sure it is still Teresa Jennings who is coming back into the room. So it is the fingerprint linked to the finger of my hand that identifies me. That information goes back to the LexisNexis or other facility and is stored. Why? Well, because in this instance, not for the bar exam, but let's say it's an exam where you have to be recredentialed, they may need to know that indeed you're coming back 2 years later and it is still the same individual. Now, I think the nuances that the staff put together in the new draft of the bill is that if the individual says, I'm done with being licensed and I don't like my fingerprint being stored anywhere, then yes, we do have a mechanism to take yourself out of there and to clean that and delete it out of the system. But while our client is still active in assuring that you are the individual who took the exam, it's important to have that record still on file.
And let's go back to the very first time, and I think this may be getting at Senator Passman's question. If not, he can follow up. But let's go back to that very first time, let's just use me for an example, that I decided to take the bar exam. Who makes sure that it's Hollis French that puts his thumbprint down or his fingerprint down for the very first time?
That would be the client. So they determine what information they want in order to verify who you are.
Whether it's a driver's license, passport, birth certificate, family member vouching, I mean, they can establish their
Indeed.
Own criteria.
Indeed.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
And we don't set what goes into that security deposit box. We just hold it. They tell us when to let go of it. We give it back or we destroy it.
Thank you. Senator Pascman has one more question or maybe more.
Cumulatively, how many American fingerprints do you have in storage in any format?
Chris, I'm not sure if you have American. I believe we have about 1 million records from 86 countries. And that also means that 86 countries have decided that the United States has the best security to hold that information. Chris, do you know?
Yeah, that's correct, Terry. Mr. Chairman and Senator, according to our business unit, we have over 1 million biometric records from 86 countries. They didn't whack it up for us as far as country by country. But you could expect that number to grow. And as my colleague Terry had mentioned, these other countries have chosen us because they think the United States and our security system is the best in the world.
Thank you for that. Follow-up questions? Don't see any. Ms. Jennings, was there anything else that you wanted to add while we have you on the line?
No, sir. I just thank you and the rest of the committee for your time, and I also thank the staff for working with us. And we are supportive of what they've put together in this committee substitute, so thank you.
Wonderful. You may want to stay on the line. We've got a couple other folks to testify, and that may provoke more questions from the committee for you or Mr. Oswald. Next up is Tim Pearson. Tim Pearson, if you would put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Yes, my name is Timothy J. Pearson. I live at 3941 Starburst Circle, Anchorage, Alaska, 99517 in Senate District M. I testify in opposition to the proposed revisions to SB 98. Number one, the new language mandates providing of biometric data, section 18.14.010B states unless the individual's biometric data is needed for a specific authorized law enforcement, security, or fraud prevention purpose, an individual may at any time revoke or amend the individual's consent, end quote. Security or fraud protection is in the eyes of the beholder. Any company may then claim these purposes in requiring biometric data. It provides no alternative forms of identification in this bill. Number two, under section 18.14.010, disposal, this creates a timed out, opt-out system. An individual must request in writing that the individual's biometric data be removed and permanently destroyed. It requires us to trust that the collector and the collector's contractor, if any, shall remove and destroy the biometric data. ChoicePoint in January 26, 2006 was fined $10 million in civil penalties and $5 million for customer redress for data security breach charges by the Federal Trade Commission. At least 800 cases of identity theft arose from the company's data breach. The personal financial records of more than 163,000 customers in its database had been compromised. The Federal Trade Commission charged that its security and record handling procedures violated the consumers' privacy rights and federal laws. This was the largest fine in the history of the FTC. A useful rule of thumb is that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. I would not recommend trusting ChoicePoint or other data mining companies. Number two, collecting biometric data is a poor security practice. Once collected, even if by a simple employer for security purposes, but then stolen, biometric data cannot be replaced. A person cannot get a new set of fingerprints. They will have to live for the rest of their lives with the issues of a compromised identity, always questioned, always in fear of how it might be used against them. Security experts recommend other techniques, like multi-factor authentication to establish database, computer, and building security. Note, multi-factor authentication is an electronic token carried by a user that repeatedly generates a time-based number that must be appended to a password when a person logs in. However, not even multi-factor authentication is perfect. creation of such sensitive databases of irreplaceable biometric data create the Willie Sutton effect. In effect, the bank robber who robbed banks because that's where the money is. A case in point. On March 17, 2011, 11 days ago, the New York Times reported that the RSA Security Division of the EMC Corporation had said on Thursday, the 16th, that it had suffered a sophisticated data breach potentially compromising security, computer security products widely used by corporations and governments. RSA is a highly respected company and widely used in the security community. I quote from the article, "The company, which pioneered an advanced cryptographic system during the 1980s, sells products that offer stronger computer security than simple password protection. RSA, which is based in Bradford, Massachusetts, posted an urgent message on its website on Thursday referring to an open letter from its chairman, Art Covilio. The letter acknowledged that the company had suffered from an intrusion Mr. Covilio described as, quote, an advanced persistent threat, end quote. Despite the lack of detail, several computer security specialists said the breach could pose a real threat to companies and government agencies who rely on the technology. One possibility, said Whitfield Diffie, a computer security was an inventor of cryptographic systems now widely used in electronic commerce, is that the master key, a large secret number used as part of the encryption algorithm, might have been stolen. The worst case could be that the intruder could produce cards that replicate the ones supplied by RSA, making it possible to gain access to corporate networks and computer systems. Mr. Diffie's vice president for information security and cryptography at the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers. This is relevant in that Section 1814.60, storage of biometric information, provides for, quote, a collector and contractor shall store individual's biometric information in a secure manner, which may include encryption or other appropriate method to ensure that the identity of the individual who provided the biometric information is protected, end quote, in the bill. Such encrypted security is a false security. The only way to protect biometric data, which cannot be replaced, you cannot get new fingerprints if they are stolen, is not to collect it. I urge return to the language of SB version B, SB 98 version B, which provides for alternative forms of identification, U.S. passport, or identification card issued by a state in the United States or by a branch of the armed forces of the United States. Please protect the privacy interests of Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. We have Horst Popperl on to answer questions, and we also have Jason Jaimo on to testify. Mr. Jaimo, can you hear me?
Jason Jaimo.
Hi, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Jaimo.
Why don't you go first, Horst?
Oh, no, go ahead, Mr. Jaimo. Go ahead first. I'll wait for you.
Okay. Well, this is Jason Jaimo, president of NetGain Business Consultants. Well, considerably less eloquent than the people from Reed Elsevier, I will say that the arguments of why you need fingerprints for exam testing are just as absurd now as they were 3 years ago when I started this whole process to ban that practice. The fact that a passport is not adequate security to take a test is just absurd, and there's no polished way to dance around that question. It's just not a realistic security threat. And in fact, it's not just a passport. They require many, many different types of ID to take that test. They take a digital photo. You have to have papers that were issued by the issuing tester, AICPA or whoever, NASBA in this case. They take a digital photo, as I mentioned. The U.S. passport can be ID. Driver's license can be ID. The fact that you can travel the world on a U.S. passport, but you can't sit down at a computer terminal in Spinard to take a test because it's not adequate ID is sort of silly, and it really is no way to talk around that question. In fact, it's so bad that same practice, Senator Pascan, you mentioned the bar exam. This issue came up in Canada as well. I'm sure the people at Reed Elsevier know about this, someone challenged the practice of requiring fingerprints to sit for the bar exam in Canada. The bar, and what they took it all the way up to the office of the Privacy Commission of Canada, and they ruled that under the new Canadian privacy laws, PIPEDA, PIPEDA, that fingerprinting for exam test taking is in fact now illegal in Canada. It's not needed. It's unreasonably intrusive, and there's no reason to allow companies to mandate the collection of employees' fingerprints to be used in conjunction with either building security or any other reason. This would be very risky to do as a policy in Alaska, and I would very strenuously urge this committee to reject that. Reed Elsevier has 9.3 billion reasons to argue this case. That was their revenue last year. Biometrics is a big multi-billion-dollar business, as you know, and we live in a world where an individual's data collected in Haines Junction can be shipped around the world to Bangladesh in a matter of seconds. This bill, the changes in this bill, effectively take out all real assurances to Alaskans that their data will be, first of all, not collected and then protected once if it was. There's no way to effectively regulate the use of private data once it's been collected. The time to stop the global data miners is at the gate, not after they got in. For that reason, I'm more than surprised than anyone to be actually testifying against this bill today, or at least against the changes that were proposed this morning. I urge you to put real protection for Alaskans back into this bill. Include the section 18.14.20 of the previous bill about exemption from fingerprinting for ID for individuals who present a U.S. passport and driver's license. Once hacked, and they would be at some point, an individual will be at risk for the rest of their life. Because as Tim mentioned, fingerprints are like passwords that can never be changed. Why did this legislature stand up for Alaska's privacy to fight the Real ID Act? Why not just put secondary usage restrictions on that data? And the reason is because it doesn't work. This is why industry lobbyists always push for it, because it's not effective, it's not enforceable. One of the representatives mentioned to me that data miner ChoicePoint, LexisNexis, flew a team of East Coast lobbyists up to Juneau to influence this bill last Wednesday. Naturally, they, along with the Security Industry Association, all profit from the collection and exploitation of Alaska's loss of privacy. Why they're even involved in this discussion and why they have appeared to have such influence over the bill is bewildering to me. They're not legitimate stakeholders in this conversation, and they should be excluded entirely from it. Their motivation is not protecting Alaskans, but making money off of them. Again, for that reason, I urge you to put real protection back into this bill, include the section 18.14.20 about exempting people from fingerprinting for ID if they present a U.S. passport or driver's license. Thank you.
Mr. Gemmo, thank you. Last, we have Mr. Popperl.
My name is Horst Popperl. I live at 67 Orchid Circle in Anchorage, Alaska.
Mr. Popperl, hold on 1 second. We're getting a lot of feedback from you. Are you on a speakerphone or on a cell phone?
Oh, is this better?
Much better.
Ah, okay, sorry. My name is Horst Popperl. I live at 627 Orchid Circle in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been a resident of Alaska since 1986, and I've been an IT professional for the last 27 years, which is my entire career. This is the third time I've testified on this bill. And a couple of things I'm going to say today, I'd really like you to pay attention to the fact that I have spent my entire career in the IT industry. I've worked in almost every area, settled in network communications area. I've started two high-tech companies. So I'm pretty well-versed in IT and data communications, data storage, the works. Not necessarily the most expert on it, but I'm very knowledgeable. The whole purpose behind this bill is to prevent the collection of the data to begin with. Trying to legislate its use after it's been collected is a no-go. It can't be enforced, period. Once you've coughed up the data, it's only a matter of time before you get screwed. You cannot take it back. Senator French made a very intuitive observation. I was going to do it, but he beat me to it. The other IDs are used to verify the initial fingerprint. If the other ID is good enough for that, why on earth do you need the fingerprint to begin with? At what point can we use the term stupid to describe this train of thought? I sent out a link to a website a while back that showed chronological data breaches. I really urge the senators and representatives to take a look at that link. It will curl your toes. There are data breaches going on every single day. The idea that ChoicePoint has some sort of magic technology that can prevent these data breaches is not only historically wrong, it is plain and simply technologically wrong, period. That's coming from a person in the IT industry. Borealis Broadband, for example, collects only the absolute minimum information we need on our clients and our customers. That is by policy. The reason we do that is because we know that any data kept is at risk. No matter what we do, no matter how much time we spend on data security, we know that there is always a risk. The best way we protect ourselves and our customers is to not collect the data and at the very beginning. If we don't have it, it can't be stolen. Data can also be intercepted through the transmission, encryption or no encryption. Anybody with a reasonable knowledge in data communication can intercept queries to Citrix systems and other types of systems that are being transmitted across the Internet. Now, let me paint you a picture of what's available already out there. For each one of you and me, spending habits, shopping habits, online habits, income, expenses, personal preferences, where you traveled, what you bought, when you bought it, when you were there. And here's something else you might not be aware of. If I set up a company to buy the prints or the image of the prints for a particular security reason, if I have that digital image on my computer, I can take what's called a phaser laser printer. And they're pretty cool because they use a combination of ink and wax to put an impression on the paper. The cool thing about that is if you use that kind of a printer to print your letterhead will be raised off the page. Very nice. Got a very cool texture to it. Those printers will run you anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000. Now, if I have your print image, I can take any image manipulation program, typically, depending on what format it's in, reverse the print, print it on a piece of paper, and voila, I have a wax impression of your fingerprint. Now, what on earth could I do with that? I'll let your imagination figure that one out, but I can tell you I can do a lot with it. As far as removing the data is concerned, like ChoicePoint and some of the language in the current bill says, forget it. The data is never removed. Once it hits the Internet or someone's database, they can tell you what they are removing data till they're blue in the face. I can guarantee you it will still float out there. Try removing yourself from the no-fly list. Good luck with that. And that's data held by our own government. There are always tons of backups. Removal of the data is a lie. Okay, I'm going to come right out and say it. It's a lie. It's going to be almost impossible to verify. A nation, like I said before, is comprised of its citizens. As far as security is concerned, you cannot enhance security by ratting out your citizens, period. The best way to enhance security is to maintain our privacy, to maintain our dignity, and to maintain our rights. You, as I see it, are representatives. You represent Alaskans, not Choice Point, not other countries, but Alaskans. And in my personal opinion, the proper decision here, clearly, is to prevent the collection of this data at the very beginning. Do not allow a for-profit company to talk you into ratting out Alaskans. And thank you. I appreciate you allowing me to testify again.
Mr. Popril, thank you. Don't see any questions. Ms. Jennings, if you're still on the line, I'm going to ask you a question, but I'm afraid I think I already know the answer. If I were to say, gee, why do you need these fingerprints? Why can't you just use a passport? I'm afraid you'd just say, we're not the ones who want it. It's our clients. Is that right?
I would indeed say that. They set the standards that they need to verify the individuals for the particular purpose, and we hold that information for them. So we do not dictate what they ask for. We hold it in a secure place for them and truly destroy it when they ask us to destroy it. It is destroyed.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Senator Pasquin.
I have a comment. In listening to this information, I think that a distinction should be made between job-specific requirements, in other words, access to a room or something like that, and proof of who one is. And the only reason on the test takers with the professional test takers is that is a reason why they need to have fingerprints to get after professional test takers. And so, you know, I'm just troubled. I think it's over-inclusive under Alaska's privacy laws to say we're going to require everyone to do something to target professional test takers. You know, there's got to be less broad means of getting after professional test takers than requiring every Alaskan that wants to take a test to give a fingerprint when they do have adequate identification. I mean, I'm just thinking kind of loosely at the moment. And so I think the distinction has to be made between job-specific requirements and proof of who one is.
Thank you. I guess so. What we haven't heard from are the customers. We hear Reed Elsevier saying, "Look, we're just doing what we're asked to do." I hear the privacy advocates saying this information really shouldn't be required. What we haven't heard from are the folks who want the fingerprints to verify identity and want the fingerprints to make their business work better, or their test, or their access, whatever it may be. That's just an observation. We sort of have a missing segment of the population in the debate here. But all I can do is ask questions of the witnesses I have. Further comments and observations? Don't hear or see any. With that, why don't we go ahead and set the bill aside. We've got the CS in front of us. Members can chew on it for a day or so. And unless anyone has any concrete solutions or ideas, we'll pass along to the next committee in the near future. But it is new to us today, so let's go ahead and do that. Good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Senate Bill 15, brought to us by Senator Meyer. I see him in the audience and his faithful staff. Welcome. We spend a lot of time together in this room, mornings and afternoons sometimes, but we do good work here. Welcome.
Indeed.
Nice
Thank
to see you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Put yourself on the record. Tell us about your bill.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Meyer, and I'm a senator from South Anchorage, Senate District 0. And I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 15, which would increase the penalty for convicted sex offenders and child kidnappers who are attempting to buy alcohol for minors, people under age 21. Now, obviously, there's already penalties for people who purchase for minors, and certainly for people who exploit minors sexually or just sexual assault. But what this would do, my attempt here, is to prevent these guys who are buying for minors in return of sexual favors. That's what the bill is attempting to do. And basically what we're saying is that, hey, if you've been convicted of a sex penalty and you've been let go and now you're buying alcohol for minors, then you know you need to be taken out of society. You're a danger. So that's what we're trying to do here, Mr. Chairman. In a nutshell, we're trying to not allow people to use alcohol as a means of getting sexual favors from minors. We've had several people testify at past committees, and I think with today being a holiday, I'm not sure they're available today. We do have Ms. Carpinetti available to talk about the bill itself and how it's drafted. I understand that we do need to put in the bill somewhere that we want folks that are on the sex registry, not just necessarily convicted of a sexual penalty. So that's a change that needs to be done. And I'm sure, this being the Judiciary Committee, it's only had a Hess hearing. You may find other tweaks that we need to make to the bill itself. And other than that, we're here for questions.
Fantastic. Maybe just for orientation purposes, in the title of the bill, but not in the title of the bill, but on lines 5 and 6, you make reference to 3 different statutes. Maybe you can just refresh our recollection about what those statutes are.
For the record, my name is Christine Marisig, and I'm staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer. To the chair and members of the committee, I'll go over briefly what those statutes are. In reference to line 5 on the front of page, 416.051, this is furnishing or delivering alcoholic beverage to persons under the age of 21. This is part of the Title IV, looking at, who's providing alcohol to whom. The next set of statutes that's referenced is 416.051. 055 is room rental for the purposes of consuming alcoholic beverages. Once again, that is also in Title IV already. About
what was the title? I missed the first word.
Room rental for the purposes of consuming alcoholic beverages.
Room rental. Okay. That's a new one on me.
Why would we rent the room for the purpose of consuming alcoholic beverages? Here's a very good example. You may recall that, sir, that in the Anchorage Daily News this past year, there was some discussion about sex trafficking and how women that were attending AFN would get lured into either sex trade or providing sexual favors, and what would happen is people would come with either alcohol or drugs that would sort of lure them away from that particular setting and brought into that kind of situation. This is not uncommon. So apparently in our statute we already have that, and so we specifically made reference to it. 416.57, it's also a permitting person under 21 years of age to possess liquor in a dwelling. A lot of times alcohol is used as a grooming tool for young people. If we look at some of the statistics that we've been presented in previous HES committees, Senate HES committees, there's an Anchorage report out there that talks about how a majority of sexual assault happens to women under the age of 19, about 30% of them. And then if you further go into that report, it shows that almost half of all sexual assault has alcohol involved. And so, once again, it's looking at those people who would be looking to provide alcohol to those who are underage for the purposes of committing some sort of sexual assault or trying to get sexual favor from them.
Yes, and so I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I agree with the concept. I think it's a great idea. And so I just want to make sure we do our due diligence here in the committee and make sure we've walked through it. Any other questions for the bill sponsor or Ms. Marisigan? Don't see any. We do have Doug Moody on the line to answer questions, and we've got law and corrections in the room. Maybe we can hear from Ms. Carpinetti and just have her step through the bill. Thank you. Ms. Carpinetti, welcome. Please come forward. Put yourself on the record.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And my only comment on the bill, which I brought to Senator Meyer this morning, is that I noticed that the definition of sex offender or child kidnapper cross-references 1 in 1263-100, mm-hmm. which defines sex offender or child kidnapper as a person who has been convicted in this state or another jurisdiction of a sex offense or child kidnapping offense on or before 1999. What this means is that a person who has to register for 15 years, maybe 20 years later, they would still come under this provision to raise. And that's something that I don't know whether it has been considered. So I just was going to suggest that you might say committed by a person who is required to register as a sex offender under AS 1263, so that this would apply to people who are currently required to register, but not people who sometime in the past have been convicted of a sex offense but are no longer required under the law to register.
So that's on page 1. That'd be in line between line 9 and 10. You'd just say that was committed by a person required to register as
a sex offender or child kidnapper under AS 1263, and then you wouldn't need this definition of sex offender or child kidnapper.
Okay, we'll take that as a conceptual amendment and get it back in front of the committee at a future hearing in the near future. Senator Pasquin.
Well, I tend to agree with that because the definition, if I read the definition of sex offender, generally it can include such things as indecent exposure under 1141-460.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Pasquin, that may come under this bill if it's a registrable offense. It just depends. I mean, I think that offense you talked about for a second conviction does have to register as a sex offender. So it's pretty broad.
Okay, so just one question at a time. So, and I think I understand what's happening, just so the record's clear. Senator Pasquin's pointing out that, or Ms. Carpinetti just pointed out, that on your second conviction for indecent exposure, you become a registered sex offender, and that would put you under the structures of this bill should you in the future serve alcohol to a minor.
That's true. I stand corrected. I mean, under 1263, a sex offense is included as a registrable offense if the person is convicted of indecent exposure and the exposure is before a person under 16 years of age, and it's a second offense.
Okay. Records
so it's not every indecent exposure.
Two things.
Senator Pasquin, just to make sure that there's an additional requirement as to the 1141-460, which is the indecent exposure, that it has to be before a person under the age of 16.
Yes, and it has to be a second offense, second conviction for that same offense.
And then, both times under 16.
Yes.
Got it.
And then the second one was under 1161-118, harassment in the first degree.
Harmful offensive contact?
Correct.
Is that a registrable offense?
Yes, it is. If it's a second conviction for the offense, and that is that was added last year, and that's what we call in our office. That's offensive touching where the victim doesn't have time to register his or her objection to the touching. It has happened often where somebody in a bar tends
right,
to be
right.
Somebody grabs a person. In Juneau, actually, it's happened a couple times in downtown bars. They've grabbed another person's genitals, and the person is so surprised they haven't had time to say, "Don't do that." And if you're convicted of a second offense,
second one of those, you become a registered.
You are required to register as a sex offender. Yes.
You shouldn't be doing that.
You shouldn't.
So if I understand the proposed language, would put the registration requirement with the sex offender?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Pasquin. The way it's drafted now, I read it to mean that that you could be a sex offender and have come off the registry, but you would still have been convicted of one of these offenses that are defined as registrable as a sex offender. If you change it to the way I've suggested, it applies to
15-year period.
15-year period for some people and life for many people.
Right.
So, for some people it wouldn't matter, but for people who are required to register for 15 years, it would matter.
That's something that the sponsor can live with. Nodding his head. Just so I'm clear, this is a approach to aggravate the penalties for serving alcohol to minors. It isn't an aggravator to the sex offense itself. It's a separate set of statutory punishments for the underlying crime, but a separate crime of serving alcohol to minors.
Yes, that's correct. It's not an aggravating factor.
Right.
It's an increased penalty for
that.
Committing certain offenses while you have to register as a sex offender.
Sure. And so it's also not... and there may be separate provisions, but just so I'm clear, it's not a separate punishment for a first offender. First offender serving alcohol to a minor, gets the minor drunk, has sex with her against her will. It's just, you know, say it's that scenario. You'd be subject to the normal penalties for serving alcohol to a minor, and whatever sex assault penalties arise out of that. But you wouldn't be captured under this statute because you're not a convicted sex offender yet.
Right, and you're not required to register at that
right.
point, yes.
Senator Coggin.
Time for the non-lawyer question.
Feel free.
Sorry. So if you have had a previous conviction and you have to register, and then you get caught serving to a minor. Is there a case that you're there's a double jeopardy issue under this type of a construct?
Through the chair, that's a good question. I don't think so. I don't think that would constitute double jeopardy because it would just be an aggravated penalty for the same act, an increased penalty because of circumstances in your past. And right. And through the chair, we do that all the time in criminal law. Consequences are more severe if
felon in possession. Sure. That's a perfect example where we penalize you for carrying a gun because you've been convicted of a felony. Mm-hmm. You were convicted of a felony 10 years ago. You're carrying a gun now. You can't do that.
Okay.
And it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
So if there's a prior conviction, then it sets the stage for if you do something bad again, then it just adds to that. That's a common.
Right.
I'm learning.
I mean, actually, this is even a better example. I mean, most people are allowed to carry guns, right? That's not normally against the law if you carry a gun. It's always against the law to serve alcohol to a minor.
Right.
Every time. And we're just making it worse for people who have a history of sex crimes.
I agree with what we're trying to do. I just don't want it to get tangled up where the whole thing gets thrown out.
Right. So. No. And it's, I mean, I really, as I think about it, you know, the sponsor's really onto something because a lot of times you don't catch a sex offender, you want to catch them before they commit another sex crime, and it is an absolutely predictable feature of their behavior to start finding young people who are not from a strong family that are, you know, sort of running loose, and you start enticing them into your orbit through alcohol. I mean, it's just, it happens over and over and over, where it's very attractive for teenagers, you know, to have a crash pad or an apartment or a mobile home or whatever. And, you know, the friendly, creepy uncle has beer there or wine or whatever, and that's how you sort of make friends with young people. And so I think Senator Myers really got a good idea here. Further questions from the members of the committee? Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. We do have Doug Moody. Are you on the line to answer questions or to testify?
To answer questions.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else here in the room that wants to testify about SB 15? Anybody else online? If not, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. We'll have invited testimony only after this point. And we will hold the bill over to make the amendment suggested by Ms. Carpinetti. And unless there's something else to come in front of the committee, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.
Thank you, Jeff.
You bet.